Hey, we're coming down to the final summer season, and a lot of folks are still on vacation, but I'm glad you're here today. Turn around to a neighbor and say good morning, or I'm glad you're here, or something like that, all right? As Hunter said, if you're visiting with us, welcome. We're glad you're here, and feel free to pick up a free gift on the way out, and we hope you are. We just want to say thank you for choosing us today to worship with. Glad you're here, and as we approach this sermon today, you know we're in this ongoing series in the book of Ruth, but I want to introduce it this way because we're coming up on this big proposal that Boaz is going to have to make to Ruth. Actually, it's the other way around. Ruth will propose to him, all right? It got me thinking, how many of you guys remember when you proposed to your wife? All right. Now, for you women, you may not realize this. It's a very frightening moment for us guys to do this. Okay, it really is. I met Audrey in the summer of 1978. It was Mother's Day. I had been sent from the State Baptist Convention of North Carolina to first come down and be introduced to her church. It was Temple Baptist Church here in Wilmington, North Carolina. And then do a 10-week youth corps, meaning I'd be their summer youth pastor for that summer for 10 weeks. We met each other, and we became friends, all right? We never dated. We just were friends, okay? And through our years together, we stayed in contact through letters and through phone calls. And if you remember back then, I hate to tell you this, you younger folks, we didn't have cell phones. We didn't have computers. We did it the old-fashioned way. We wrote each other, okay? And if we made a long-distance call to each other, you paid per minute. So our long-distance bill was way up there, all right? And so through those years, we stayed together. I moved around the country after I graduated. I went to NC State, and after I graduated, I went on to Southwestern Baptist Theological Seminary in Texas, and I was there for a year. And a friend of mine said, hey, you've been in the Bible Belt your entire life. You need to get outside the Bible Belt and see what the world is like outside of Baptist control. I said, all right, where should I go? He said, you need to go to Golden Gate Baptist Theological Seminary. We have six seminaries in our denomination, and one of them is located right across from the Golden Gate Bridge, right across from San Francisco. So I said, all right, I'll go out there. All right, so I go out there. I finish up my schooling there. When I did that, I came back to Nashville, Tennessee, did an internship through what is now called Lifeway. Back then, it was called the Baptist Bookstore, if you remember. But it's now called Lifeway, and I did an internship there. I also went on staff of a church called First Baptist Church Old Hickory. I also had another full-time job. Another friend of mine said, hey, you need to see what it's really like to work before you go into full-time ministry. So I got into then, I'm dating myself, home computers were just coming out. So I got a job with Canon USA, selling home computers and those kinds of things, and I was making really good money. During this time, Audrey and I were staying in touch with each other, and just I just said, why don't you come and visit me, okay? Now, and so I set up in my church a family for her to stay with. They'd built this beautiful, beautiful log cabin. They'd gone to all these warehouses that were being torn down and pulled out these huge beams to be the support around that house and inside the house. So she stayed with them. And so we kind of saw each other. We got back in touch with each other and connected to each other. And that was around 1985, I guess it was, somewhere around there. She's sitting over there. She can correct me if I'm wrong, okay? All right. And so then I came down to see her. I had her come back up and see me. We did this. Now, get this. We never officially really dated like you date. Okay? Because when you date, you're usually in the same town, right? At least the same state. I lived in Tennessee. She lived here in Wilmington, North Carolina. We saw each other maybe four or five times. And so I decided, it's time to pop the question. Okay? It's time to pop the question. So in July of 1985, I had her fly up and had her stay with some friends. And so, again, I had never proposed. I didn't know how you do this. Okay? So we went to a little park called Centennial Park in Nashville, Tennessee. All right? See if you can bring up the pictures here, all right? It should be the next slide, all right? This is the park. This is July 13th, 1985. That's us way back on a blanket. I proposed. I said, would you marry me? And she said, yes. Now, get this. I didn't have a ring. I just asked her if she'd marry me. Here's why. I ain't spending any money till she says yes. Because if you go on YouTube today, there was a guy a couple years ago at a major league hockey game during halftime. He had his girlfriend come out on the ice. He got down in the seat. He proposed to her. And in front of thousands of people, aired on ESPN, and she said no. So I didn't want no. If you ain't saying yes, there ain't no ring, girl. No, that's not why I did it. I'm telling this story. Here's what I said. Yes. I said, I'm choosing to love you. What a way to propose. But if you're going to get married, love is a choice. And it takes more than love to hold it together. And so on July 13th, I proposed that way. And while we were sitting there on this blanket, this family made us a little lunch. And if you'll see here on the pictures, we're sitting way back on this blanket. And this elderly African-American guy pulled up in his red truck. And so Audrey said, give him the camera and let him take a picture of this. So you see, he's sitting in the truck. There in his side mirror. He's holding up the camera. He takes a picture of us. Okay? After that, I run and get the camera. Run back to Audrey, and I'm not making this up. We both looked up to say thank you, and the truck was gone. It wasn't even there. Vanished in thin air. So then we went to several jewelry stores. I asked her, I said, you got to wear this thing. You pick it out. So she picked out an engagement ring. I bought it. We had it resized. And then on July 15th, here at Opryland Hotel, under a waterfall, if you've ever been there, I put the ring on her finger. And in the next picture in the middle up there, I called her mother. Her father had passed away 4 years earlier, and I asked her mother's permission to marry her. Okay? And ever since then, it's been a love affair. We've had the best 30-plus years together as husband and wife. There's been ups and downs, as there always has been. We got married right here in Temple Baptist Church, and we've been in love ever since. And we've made a conscious choice ever since to love each other. But it started out becoming best friends first. Started out as writing letters through the years, staying on phone calls with each other, that this relationship grew. And so I do this to say this. One of the most remarkable proposals we're going to see is today. It's a reverse proposal. Ruth proposes to Boaz. That's usually not how it's done. But she has a legal right by Old Testament law to do this. We're in this ongoing story called Ruth, How God Works in All Things. So I want to first show you Ruth 2, verse 23. So Ruth continued working closely with the female workers of Boaz, gathering grain until the barley harvest, which was March and April, and then the wheat harvest, which was April, May, until they had finished. And she continued to live with Naomi, her mother-in-law. So if you remember in our story, there was a famine in Israel. This family lived in Bethlehem. They went to Moab, Naomi and her husband, Elimelech. They had two twin sons who marry Moabite women. One of them is Orpah, one of them is Ruth. Over a 10-year period, Elimelech dies. The two twin boys die. And so Naomi has gotten word that the famine that was in Israel is over, so she's going to go back home. So she goes back home. Ruth goes with her. And I told you, in those days, a woman's protection and her provision was through her father or through her sons. Naomi has no husband. He has died, and both of her sons have died. She has no provision. And now Ruth, who's come with her, is a Moabite. Jews despised Moabites. They considered them unclean. So the fact that Ruth comes home with her, she comes home with great risk because she will be rejected by the Jewish people. She knows nothing of the Jewish life, religion, but she chooses to accept it and the consequences that come with it. So she comes home. She lives with her mother, Naomi, there in the village in Bethlehem. Now, as a result of this, Naomi knows that the clock is ticking. She has got to find a husband for Ruth. Look at this in verse 1. One day, Naomi said to Ruth, "My daughter, it's time that I found a permanent home for you so that you may be provided for." The Good News Translation puts it this way. Sometime later, Naomi said, "I must find a husband for you so that you will have a home in your on your own." So Naomi's already got the wheels going. She's aging. Naomi knows that there's not much time for her left to live, so she's got to find a future husband for her daughter-in-law who's lost her own husband. And so she kind of begins working on the wedding plans. And I told you, in those days, the mother planned the wedding. And most times back then, the marriages had been prearranged. But since Ruth's husband has already died, she has that. She doesn't have that. So her mother's already got her mind working. She's going, "Ruth, I'm not going to be around here for long. I've got to take care of you. It's my responsibility to get you hitched to somebody. I'm working on that. Be patient with me. In fact, I've got an idea. There's a member of my family named Boaz. He owns these fields. You need to go out there and start gleaning in those fields, and maybe you will catch his eye," which, if you've been with me through this series, she does. He immediately is enamored with her. He falls in love with her. And Naomi picks up on this. She notices this. So in Naomi's mind, there is no doubt she's somehow got to get this arrangement sealed between Boaz and Ruth. And to do that, she asks what I call a rhetorical question to Ruth. Look at this in verse 2 in chapter 3. "Now is not Boaz our kinsman?" I've been telling you that in the Old Testament, there's a thing called the kinsman redeemer. That when a woman's husband died and she had no sons to provide for her, the Old Testament law provided she could be cared for by a close male relative of the husband who died, who would take her as his wife, but all of the possessions stayed in that family of the deceased husband. And sometimes other children came through that. We see this in the book of Deuteronomy. Let me share it with you. "If two brothers are living together on the same property and one of them dies without a son, his widow may not be married to anyone from outside the family. Instead, her husband's brother should marry her and have intercourse with her to fulfill the duties of a brother-in-law. The first son she bears to him will be considered the son of the dead brother, so that his name will not be forgotten in Israel." God set this up so women would be protected and taken care of. God did not want any woman out there on her own. So in the Old Testament law, if her husband died, she could be married by someone else so that she was cared for if she had no sons. And therefore, any of the property of the dead husband stayed in that line of the dead husband, even though there was a different husband now. So according to this provision, Ruth was actually free to take the initiative. Had she never married, she would have to wait for Boaz to propose to her. But because she's been married, her husband has died, God said the woman then was free to approach a man. I kind of like how J. Vernon McGee puts it. He says, "As a widow, it was her right to let her intentions be known to the kinsman. It was her first move." She had the right to take the first move. And so Naomi says, "Hey, you've been out there and harvesting. It's pretty clear to everybody. Boaz is in love with you. He's ordered all of his servants, his hired hands, to drop the grain right in front of you so you can pick it up and bring it home. He's also providing water to you. It's clear to all of us. You may not see it, but it's clear to all of us. He loves you." Now, Ruth, as I told you, is a Moabite. And Jews despise Moabites because they came into existence through incest. But Naomi is the matchmaker. And so Ruth is a little concerned, how will this work? And Naomi basically says, "Let me work it out." Look what she tells her in Ruth 3, 2b. "Tonight, he," meaning Boaz, "will be winnowing barley in the threshing floor." Now, the Bible doesn't tell us how she found that out. But she's a woman with a plan. And she's going to get these two together. And sometime later, she knows that when this harvest season ends, both Ruth and Boaz will go their separate ways. So she's got to get them together before that happens. Jean Johnson, in her book, Christian Reader, says that her daughter Julie met a young man named Mark while they were working on the same ranch in Colorado. After Julie came home, Mark decided to pursue the relationship. He wanted a little bit more from that. On his first Sunday visiting their church, their pastor misunderstood their relationship, and he introduced Mark as Julie's future husband in front of everybody. Julie leaned over to him. She says, "You know, you have never proposed to me." He turned to her and literally said, "Will you marry me?" She said, "Yes." They got engaged right there. They got married. They've had children, and they've been happily married ever since. Anybody in here get engaged in a worship service? I'm not against it. It works, all right? And so she says, "Listen, he's going to be out on the threshing floor." In those days, the threshing floor was primarily on a plateau. It was flat. It would have rocks all surrounding it. And they would put the barley or the grain down there, and they would walk on it and stomp on it. Bring up the pictures. A couple times, they'll even bring in animals who walk on it. And they would have these forks, and they would take it and throw it up. Because the chaff was lighter, it would blow away, and the grain would fall down. And what you see to the left there is all of what's left of the grain. And so they would do this winnowing over and over, sometimes using animals, sometimes using their own feet. And so as they pitched it up, the chaff blew away, the grain fell to the bottom. It took a lot of time to do this. Now you got to realize, they are celebrating. Why? There has been a 7-year famine. This is the very first crop in 7 years in Israel. So this is a time of celebration. Yes, it's hot. Yes, it's hard. Yes, it's labors. But they are excited. They're thrilled because now they have grain that they can use to eat. You remember there was the famine. In Ruth 1:1, it puts it this way. In the days when the judges ruled in Israel, a severe famine came upon the land. So a man from Bethlehem in Judah left his home and went to live in the country of Moab, taking his wife and two sons with him. That's Elimelech and his wife Naomi and their two sons. They lived in Bethlehem. Bethlehem is a combination of two Hebrew words, Beit Lechem, which means house of bread. And for 7 years, the house of bread had no bread because of the famine. And we know from other passages in the book of Ruth, this famine lasted 7 years. Think about this. How would you function if you went to Harris Teeter or Food Lion or wherever and the shelves were empty for 7 years? There was no grain. There was no harvest. There was nothing to eat. People were starving to death. This is one of the darkest periods in Israel's history because people literally starved to death. Why was there a famine? Because they were under a curse by God. God had warned them in the book of Leviticus. He'd warned his people this. Look at this. If you walk in my statutes and observe my commandments and do them, then I will give you your rains in their season, and the land shall yield its increase, and the trees of the field shall yield their fruit. Your threshing, meaning your threshing floors, shall last to the time of the great harvest, and the great harvest shall last to the time of sowing. And you shall eat your bread to the full and dwell in your land securely. But if you will not listen to me and will not do these statutes, commandments, if you spurn my statutes, and if your soul abhors my rules so that you will not do all my commandments but break my covenant, then I will do this to you. I will break the pride of your power, and I will make your heavens like iron and your earth like bronze. And your strength shall be spent in vain, for your land shall not yield its increase, and the trees of the land shall not yield their fruit. They are under a curse from God because of their disobedience. We saw this earlier in this series in Judges 21:25. It said this, in the days of the judges, Israel had no king. So the people did whatever seemed right in their eyes and opinion. Sounds like America today. People just do what they think is right. They define morality the way they want to define it. And not only did God cause a famine, he caused something else to happen to them. Also, we find this in the book of Judges. The Israelites did evil in the Lord's sight, so the Lord handed them over to the Midianites for 7 years. That's the 7 years of famine. The Midianites were so cruel that the Israelites were made hiding places for themselves in the mountains, caves, and strongholds. Whenever the Israelites planted crops, Marauders from Midian and Amalek and the people of the east would attack Israel, camping in the land and destroying the crops as far away as Gaza. They left the Israelites with nothing to eat, taking all the sheep, goats, cattle, and donkeys. The enemy hordes coming with their livestock and tents were as thick as locusts. They arrived on droves of camels, too numerous to count, and they stayed until the land was stripped bare. So Israel was reduced to starvation by the Midianites. No sooner can they plant a crop, Midianites come in and destroy it. No sooner can they get a goat, Midianites come in and steal it. They were under a curse by God. C.S. Lewis puts it this way: God whispers to us in our pleasure, speaks in our conscience, but shouts in our pains. It is his megaphone to rouse a deaf world. So God used pain, starvation, and death to get his people's attention. And he did it for 7 years. And they finally repent. Look at the last part of Judges 6:6. So Israel was reduced to starvation by the Midianites. Then the Israelites cried out to the Lord for help. And as soon as they repented, God relented, and the land began to produce crops again. The famine was gone. Sometimes God does that to you. He does it to me. We live our lives. We make our own choices. We decide what we think is right and wrong, no matter what God's word says. So he says, all right, I'm going to bring a financial famine to you. I'm going to bring a relational famine to you. I'm going to bring a health famine to you. I'm going to bring a relationship famine to you or a career famine to you. The Bible says, be not deceived. Our God will not be mocked. We may think we can live our lives however we want to, but if we want his blessings, it comes with obedience. And it took 7 years for the Israelites to learn that. And sometimes it may take us years to learn that. Eventually, the famine ends. Crops begin to grow. People are celebrating. They're partying. And so Naomi is working behind the scenes. Let's get this proposal going. She knows this is their last chance. Once May ends, the harvest season is over, and Boaz and Ruth will go their separate ways. So Naomi comes up with a plan. Notice this in verses 3a. Now do as I tell you. Take a bath. That was probably good advice. You've been out in the hot sun all day, winnowing. It's probably good advice. Take a bath. Now, the Hebrew word translated as bath here, or wash, depending on your own translation, rashitsis. This Hebrew word refers to a full and thorough cleansing, or a bath a woman would do for on her wedding day, or when she planned to have sexual relations with her husband. She would cleanse herself from head to toe. So Ruth says, listen, you want me to do what? Naomi says, you're going to propose to Boaz, but first thing, you're going to take a bath. Today, when girls are getting married, they get a manicure, they get a pedicure. And maybe whatever the Mary Kay was that day came out and helped her with that. Brides on their wedding day do this today. They get pedicures and get manicures. Ruth says next, look what she says, and anoint yourself. In other words, Ruth, don't just bathe yourself, put on your best perfume. I love what J. Vernon McGee says about this. He says, Ruth's favorite perfume probably was called Midnight in Moab. Did you put on any cologne or perfume when you came here today? Of course you did. So she's trying to help Ruth with this. Listen, he is much older. You're much younger. You have really got to spruce this up. I know he's in love with you, but he's being very cautious right now. We've got to turn the tables and force a move. She has thought out everything, even the timing of when this proposal should occur. Look what she tells Ruth. And dress in your nicest clothes. Why? Because this is going to take place in the middle of the night, this proposal. He needs to know it's a woman that he's talking to. And he needs to know if he calls for a lantern and he holds it up, you're looking good. Look at the last part of 3. Then go where his threshing floor, where he's threshing, but don't let him know you're there until he has finished eating and drinking. What a wise woman. Timeless advice. We say in our culture, a way to a man's heart is how? through his stomach. Let him fatten himself up. Let him have a good meal. Good advice, wives. If you've dented a car, feed your husband first before you tell him. Kid comes home with a bad report card, don't tell your husband first. Give him a good meal. That's what Naomi's doing. Let's make him happy, fat and happy. Don't hit him up front with this till after he's had a good meal. Then look what she says. Watch him so you know where he lies down to sleep. When he lies down, go to sleep. When he lies down to go to sleep, then lift the cover off and uncover his feet and lie down. He will tell you what you should do. That's important advice. You got all these guys sleeping out in the open air, covered up. She's saying, make sure you know which one is Boaz. Because you could lay down next to one of his workers, and it'd be very bad. I have a good friends, Ron and Rita Wade. Ron has now retired. He was majored in chemistry. He majored in chemistry. He worked for DuPont. And sometimes Ron would work very late. One weekend, his in-laws were coming to town, Rita's parents. And when they always came to town, they stayed in the guest room. Well, while Ron was at work, Rita changed her mind. So when her parents arrived, she said, look, just take our master bedroom. Ron and I'll sleep in the guest bedroom. She didn't tell Ron that. Ron came home at 3 o'clock in the morning smelling like chemicals. He went and took a shower. Went into the master bedroom, climbed in bed, butt naked, thinking it was Rita. All of a sudden, he hears, Ron, it's Mom. He said, I've never made a dash out of a bed so fast in my life. And that's Naomi's point. You better make sure it's Boaz you're laying down next to, or this is going to go south very quickly. Good advice. See, here's a reason. And when you read this, you study this, a lot of liberal scholars will tell you that what Ruth does here has sexual connotations because of the word that is used. Okay? You see it here on the screen. The Hebrew word translated here as markhelote, as feet, is plural and can mean feet or legs or the area near the legs. There are some liberal scholars who say that because the same Hebrew word was used as a metaphor for a man's sexual organ, that is what is implied here. In other parts of the Old Testament, it does refer to sexual organs. But in this part, it does not. How do we know? Context. Context tells us everything. This is not a sexual encounter that's going on. She is simply going to uncover part of his feet. And so what Naomi instructs Ruth to do here, when he lays down, you hear him snoring, you go in, and you uncover his feet. Usually, Hebrew men wore something like this. I got this in Israel. They wore it around them. And when they went to bed at night or laid out in the field, they would cover their feet with it because it would be cold at night in the spring. And so her instructions to Ruth was this. When you hear him snoring, go up, uncover his feet. Why? Because they'll get cold. He will wake up. He will notice you're there. And he'll have a conversation with you. Look at verse 10. Now don't worry about a thing, my daughter. I will do whatever is necessary. For everyone in town knows you're a virtuous woman. All of a sudden he wakes up. He realizes this is not a sexual encounter. Look what he says. You are a what? Virtuous. There is no sexual connotation here. None of that's going on here. Though liberal scholars say it is not. Context tells us he responds with a Hebrew word that lets us know she is holy, she is godly, has nothing to do with sex. Other parts of the Old Testament, it does, but not here. In fact, Boaz will not even touch her until they are pronounced husband and wife. Look at verse 14. So Ruth laid at Boaz's feet till the morning, but she got up before it was light enough for people to recognize each other. For Boaz had said, no one must know that a woman was here at my threshing floor. He said, listen, you got to get up before the sun comes up. Now here's another thing we know, that this was not sexual. Just like we have commentaries, the Jews did too. They had a thing called the Mishnah. The Mishnah was the Jewish commentary on the Old Testament. And the Mishnah had these laws. One that says that a man was forbidden to act as a kinsman redeemer towards a Gentile woman he had already been sexually involved with. Ruth is a Gentile. He has no sexual encounter with her. This would be devastating because why? Ruth and Boaz eventually marry. They have a son named Obed. Obed has a son named Jesse. Jesse has a son named who? David. Jesus comes from this line. There is nothing sexual in this scene and in this story. If a kinsman redeemer didn't redeem the widow, she was left to live on her own. Not only was she left to live on his own, he forfeited the right to the property of the dead husband. So let me tell you what the lay at the feet means in that day. The lay at the feet of that day in that culture was also a sign of humility, in which a person doing this was asking for protection. So Naomi's suggestion to Ruth to uncover and lay at Boaz's feet would expose Boaz's feet to the chill of the night air, thus filling the chill he would awaken to take care of his discomfort. So all Ruth is asking for is protection. Because earlier in our story, he's already promised her that. It's kind of like we say today, first comes love, next comes marriage, then comes baby in a baby carriage. And that's the way it should work. That's God's provision. There's nothing sexual in this story at all. So she uncovers his feet. He feels the chill of the night. He wakes up and notices she's there. Let's go back to chapter 3. I will do everything you say, Ruth said to Naomi. So she went down to the threshing floor that night and followed the instructions of her mother-in-law. After Boaz had finished eating and drinking and was in good spirits, he laid down at the far end of the pile of grain and went to sleep. Now again, liberal scholars will say he got drunk. That's not what this Hebrew word means either. And this is what I'm finding in our culture today. People take words and they just make up their own meaning to them. And liberal scholars will say he got drunk. Nothing in this story implies he got drunk. In fact, they'll say he got drunk and then he took advantage of Ruth. That's not what is meant here. The Hebrew word translated as merry or good spirits is yatav, and it literally means to be in a good mood. Why is he in a good mood? It's not because there's a woman laying at his feet. It's because finally there's a harvest. There's food to eat. He's excited. He's thrilled. He's been out on this threshing floor. He is thrilled that there is food to now eat. Then Ruth came secretly and uncovered his feet and laid down. And in the middle of the night, the man was startled and he turned over and found a woman lying at his feet. Again, the Hebrew word translated as startle. The Hebrew word translated in the night literally means this, midnight. Ruth comes around midnight. So Boaz has been sleeping for several hours. And that was Naomi's word to her. Make sure he is in deep sleep before you get there. Make sure you're going to the right one who's laying out on that threshing floor. Crawl up, uncover his feet. He will eventually wake up from the cold, and then he will tell you what you need to do, which he did. The Hebrew translated as startle means to shiver, to tremble from the cold or the fear. And you can almost see the scene unfolding. Boaz's feet get uncovered. He's cold. He wakes up. He's startled. He's surprised to see her laying there. He realizes he's not alone. Look at verse 9. He doesn't know who this is. He hasn't read the book of Ruth yet because it hadn't been written. He goes, "Who are you?" "I'm your servant, Ruth," she replied. "Spread the corner of your covering over me, for you are my family redeemer." If we could put it in plain English, she said, "Boaz, will you marry me?" She proposes right there. I mean, you know, I like to use my imagination. Here's Boaz in his Jewish pajamas, laying out there on the threshing floor, snoring away. His hair is all messed up. His feet gets cold. He wakes up. He can't see too clearly. He looks around. There's somebody laying at his feet. He probably jumped. But because he's fallen in love with her, he's kind to her. She says, "Boaz, I've only come here for one reason, to remind you of the Old Testament responsibility you have to me. You have the legal right to marry me. Will you do it?" Now, let me explain something else here. In verse 4, Naomi's plan has been put into motion. Notice what she says. Be sure to notice where he lies down. You're going to lie down to the right guy. Then go and uncover his feet so his feet get cold. Lie down there and he will tell you what to do. Naomi believed that Boaz would respond to Ruth's gesture of marriage. So she takes into account that Boaz will do this. And now again, I'm just conjecturing here, okay? The reason I think no other Jewish man has asked Ruth to marry him is because she's a Moabite. They were considered unclean. Jews had this prejudice against Moabites. So she's moved into Bethlehem. She's probably being shunned, rejected by other Jews. But Boaz, who's this aging Jewish man, takes notice of her and falls in love with her. And Naomi sees that, so she becomes a little matchmaker. Now, before we note Boaz's answer, we need to notice something. Why has Ruth come at midnight in secrecy with her proposal? I mean, when I read this, and every time I read this, it seems a little sordid, doesn't it? In our culture, we wouldn't tell our daughters, go to your boyfriend's apartment, you have a key, go into where he's laying in bed, sit down on the floor, pull the sheets back, and see if he notices you're there. We don't do that. At least we shouldn't do that. So why? It's likely that she has come out of respect for Boaz's character. Not wanting to demand her rights publicly, she does it privately. She doesn't want to embarrass him. She could have done this in front of everybody else, but she doesn't want to put him on the spot and embarrass him in front of everybody else. She wants him to have the right to say no just to the two of them in private. Now look at his response in verses 10 through 13. The Lord bless you, my daughter, Boaz exclaimed. You are showing even more family loyalty now than you did before, for you have not gone after a younger man, whether rich or poor. Now don't worry about a thing, my daughter. I will do what is necessary, meaning I will do what the law says I'm supposed to do. For everyone in town knows that you are what? This, again, I repeat, there is nothing sexual in this scene. But while it's true that I'm one of your family redeemers, look at this. Uh-oh, Houston, we got a problem. There's another man who is more closely related to you than I am. He is second in line to redeemer. He is not first. If he is, stay right here tonight, and in the morning I will talk to him. If he's willing to redeem you, very well. Let him marry you. But if he is not willing, then as surely as the Lord lives, I will redeem you myself. Now lie down here until morning. Boaz knows the pecking order to the kinsman redeemer. This is news to Ruth. She is surprised by this. But I don't think Naomi was. See, Naomi is the matchmaker. She's got all of these bases covered. And so, she knows that Boaz is second in line, not first in line. But she probably has figured out the guy who's first in line would never marry a Moabite woman out of the shame it would bring to his family. So she knows, she's been watching, Boaz is in love with her. We just got to nip this bud real quickly and Boaz will marry her. Again, go back and look at verse 9. Boaz said, who are you to Ruth? She answered, I am Ruth, your servant. Spread your wings over your servant, for you're a redeemer. I want you to circle those two words. She identifies herself, I am your servant, and she uses a word wings. And the reason this is important is she goes back and quotes Boaz's words to her earlier in chapter 2. He uses the same Hebrew word, wings. It's a custom, a reference called a talith. A talith was this kind of shroud a bride would wear. She'd come in, her face is covered, and she's asking for protection. It was a fringe garment belonging to the groom that he would put over her until they were married officially. So Ruth asked Boaz to spread the hem of his garment over her as a symbolic gesture of that talith. All right, if you're sincere, then take what's left of your little rope here, something like this, and just put it over me. As proof, you mean you're going to keep your word. He does. But he's got to work this out first thing in the morning with this other kinsman redeemer. Look at chapter 2, verses 10 through 12. Then she, Ruth, kneeled to face downward, bowing to the ground, and said to him, Boaz, why have I found favor in your eyes that you should notice me when I'm a foreigner? This is when they first meet. Boaz answered, I have been made fully aware of everything you have done for your mother-in-law since the death of your husband. And now you have left your father and mother and the land of your birth and have come to the people that you did not know before. May the Lord repay you for your kindness and may your reward be full from the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you've come to take refuge. So when she uses the word wings, she goes back to what he has said to her in chapter 2. The Hebrew word translated as winged is kephale. Okay? It's used in 3:9, where she uses it with him, but she goes back and pulls it from chapter 2, verse 12. He has said, you're under the wings of God, under his protection. And she says, all right, if you really believe that, will you be those wings for the Lord for me? Okay? She doesn't want any misunderstanding. She wants to know for sure. So Ruth is actually asking Boaz in 3:9 to become the answer to his own prayer that he prayed in chapter 2, verse 12. She's asking Boaz to be the application of his own intercession. You said you would do this, so do it. There's really no more need to talk about this, and there's no more need to pray about this. You made a vow to God, so keep it. You made a prayer that if you had the chance to be my redeemer, you would, so do it. Now the question remains, will he get cold feet? Will he do it? I imagine he barely can contain himself. This is a woman he loves. He wants to marry her, but he's got to work this other issue out beforehand. Look at verse 10. May you be blessed by the Lord, my daughter. Now, you see, when you read that, it just sounds plain. Here's the way I think Boaz would say it if he was here today. Yeehaw! I'm going to marry you, girl. And I'm going to fix this tomorrow with this other kinsman and redeemer because I'm in love with you and you're in love with me and we're going to make this work. And as I thought about this, as I wrap up, let me give you a couple biblical applications from what we've seen so far. Okay? When time seems to be running out, God can orchestrate an encounter. As I told you, they're at the end of the harvest season. If she doesn't propose by then, they go their separate ways, and they will not see each other again to another harvest, which is in the fall. Naomi's been praying, Boaz has been praying, Ruth has been praying that God would work an encounter, and he does. I love what James 4 says. Now listen to me, you that say tomorrow and today or tomorrow we'll travel to a certain city where we'll be, say, a long year and go into business and make a lot of money. You don't even know what your life tomorrow will be. You're like a puff of smoke which appears for a moment and then disappears. What you should say is this, if the Lord is willing, we will live and do this or that. If you've got a prayer before God and the clock is ticking, trust God. If he's willing, if it's in his will, he'll make it happen. And that's what happens here. All of us take petitions to God and we wonder, is he hearing us? Is he going to answer us? Just leave it with him. He knows what's best for you. And in this case, he knew what was best for Boaz and Ruth. Here's the second thing. Instead of using victimization and manipulation when facing a dead end, use your imagination to bring glory to God through illumination. You like all those rhymes? I don't know about you, but I'm tired of people playing the victim game today. All they do is play the victim game. I'm a victim. And this is what Boaz realizes. He's not a victim. If it's either time to fish or cut bait, I need to do something or stop now. Naomi's plan to Ruth to use Boaz was not to play the victim card here. It wasn't to try to manipulate Boaz, but was to push Boaz to use his imagination to bring some illumination on how this could happen. And when I thought about this, I thought about Apollo 13. You remember that? They made a movie about it. And I remember watching the movie, and I've read articles about what happened. You all know what happened. There was an explosion. And all of a sudden, NASA got a call. Houston, we have a problem. Here they are 200,000 miles away from the Earth, and they have no way, they know, to get back. And if you watched the movie, you saw how scientists said, well, let's do this. And every time the man coordinating all this says, they don't have that there. They don't have that up there. Every idea. Guys, stop using. Get your imagination going. We know what they have. Help them figure out. Bring some illumination to what they have there with your imagination to get back here. And that's what happened. That's the only reason those astronauts made it back. In 1 Chronicles 29:18, it says this, O Lord God of Abraham, Isaac, and Israel of our fathers, keep this forever in the imagination of the thoughts, the heart of the people, and prepare their heart unto thee. Sometimes you've got to use your imagination. How do you do this? Sometimes God says, hey, you just need to think for a moment. Sometimes it's time to just move forward. Use your imagination, bring some illumination to it, and then act. Give it your best shot, we would say. Here's a third thing. Remember, when uncertain, don't assume anything, because many times things are not what they seem to be. Here's Ruth, this virtuous, godly woman, coming in at midnight, proposing to Boaz, and by outside appearance, it would look like this was some type of sexual encounter when it was not. There's a story in 2 Kings chapter 6 where the prophet Elisha is facing an oncoming army. And they are surrounded by this Armenian army, and his servant begins to panic. Look what Elisha said to his servant. Don't be afraid, Elisha told him, for there are more on our side than on theirs. Then Elisha prayed, O Lord, open his eyes and let him see. The Lord opened the young man's eyes, and when he looked up, he saw that the hillside around Elisha was filled with horses and chariots of fire. And sometimes when things seem bleak in your life, they're not bleak. In God's. Let him work it out. Trust him for it. And number four, sometimes it is wrong to keep asking God for an answer for a prayer when God wants you to be the answer for that prayer. Sometimes God says, you don't need to pray to me anymore. You need to be the one to take care of that. You need to be the one that steps up. You need to be the one that do that. That's your purpose. And Boaz does that. Look in verse 11. Now, don't worry about a thing, my daughter. I will do what is necessary. I read about a young men's retreat. Had about 30 or 40 young men there. And there was a young man named Jason. And he sat in his chair. His face was just buried in his face when they were in their small groups talking. And he just began to sob uncontrollably. One of the men said, what's wrong? He says, why didn't he want me? I don't understand. Why did my dad not want me? What's wrong with me? The man said, why are you asking? He said, as soon as I was born, my dad left. I've never seen my dad. I've never met my dad. Why didn't my dad want me? What was so wrong with me that my dad would not want me or never want to have a relationship with me? And he just began to sob and sob and sob. All the men in that group just sat there. They didn't know what to do. They didn't know what to say. Finally, an older guy named Phil got up. He walked over and he put his arms around this young man named Jason. He said, Jason, from this point on, you are my son and I am your dad. And from the day that happened until Phil died, he was the father that Jason never had. And later in an interview, when Jason was interviewed about this, he said, I never thought I had a father until God brought me Phil. And from the day at that retreat to the day Phil died, he was the dad I never had. Sometimes, Southside, you need to stop and just be the answer. For example, you see a need here at Southside. Maybe God doesn't want you to keep fishing. He wants you to cut bait. He wants you to be the answer to that need. He wants you to cut bait Because why? You are that answer. Boaz realizes that. He is the answer. There's no more reason to pray anymore. Just step up, do, and be the answer to the prayer. Boaz stepped up. Will you? Let's pray.